From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When a telemarketer calls, you're probably more concerned with how to end the call than with where the call is coming from. You might be surprised to learn that many of those calls come from India, where U.S. companies have outsourced jobs paying about a fifth of what they would pay to a domestic telemarketer. On today's Fresh Air, New York Times foreign affairs columnist Thomas Friedman talks about his documentary, The Other Side of Outsourcing. It premieres tonight on the Discovery Channel. We'll also talk about his recent columns on Iraq. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Ann Patchett's memoir, Truth and Beauty, A Friendship, about her long friendship with the late Lucy Greeley, who was best known for her memoir, Autobiography of a Face. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. There's mixed reaction on Capitol Hill to today's resignation of CIA Director George Tenet, NPR's Andrea Seabrook reports.
Those that have worked closely with Tenet, like Virginia Republican John Warner, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, say they believe Tenet is stepping down for family reasons.
I know George very well, and I take at face value what he said to me. I really do.
Some lawmakers on both sides of the aisle say they're relieved to see some changes in U.S. intelligence leadership. The top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Jane Harman, says Tenet's resignation creates an opportunity.
And that opportunity is for the president to admit that there have been major problems with recent intelligence products and that a restructuring is necessary.
Many lawmakers hailed Tenet's work under both the Clinton and Bush administrations. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, the Capitol.
Iraq's most influential religious leader has voiced qualified support for Iraq's interim government. Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani stressed that the new government is not elected, but added that he hopes it will prove its worthiness and integrity. Sistani said a UN resolution approving the transfer of sovereignty to Iraq must include restoring security, providing basic services for all, full control over political, economic, military, and security matters, and free and fair elections. Sistani issued his statement as fresh fighting broke out in the Shiite holy city of Najaf and continued in the neighboring city of Kufa. Radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr promised Shiite leaders today that he would withdraw his troops in 2 days if U.S. forces would do the same. President Bush has arrived in Rome for the first stop in a 3-day trip to Europe. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Rome.
The president will visit with Pope John Paul II at the Vatican on his first full day here. It will be their third meeting in the past 3 years. The Pope was a vocal critic of the war in Iraq, though the White House says this meeting will look forward at the work yet to be done in Iraq. Mr. Bush will also present the Pope with the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest U.S. civilian award. The president will also meet with Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, a strong backer of the war. They'll discuss the proposed United Nations resolution in support of the Iraqi interim government, which will assume power at month's end. From Italy, the president will spend a day in Paris before joining European leaders at Normandy to mark the anniversary of the D-Day invasion 60 years ago. Don Gagne, NPR News, Rome.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 67 points to close at 10,196 in active trading. Declining issues led advances by about 3-1. The Nasdaq lost 28 points to close at 1960. This is NPR News. A levee break near Stockton, California is flooding farm fields on nearby islands. The rupture is located near pipelines that carry drinking water to San Francisco. Bob Hensley reports from member station KXJZ.
The Coast Guard says the levee, located in the Central Valley's Delta region, broke about mid-morning, flooding fields of crops and forcing the evacuation of area farmers and laborers. Matt Robinson, a spokesman for the city of Stockton, says rescue crews are searching islands for people who might be stranded.
Law enforcement is going up with helicopters to take a look to see if people are on the islands that may be affected by the waters.
Engineers are on the scene trying to determine what caused the levee to break. There's concern that drinking water, which passes through the region to the Bay Area, could become contaminated. Public health officials say they're closely monitoring the situation. For NPR News, I'm Bob Hensley in Modesto.
A 14-year-old boy from Indiana won the National Spelling Bee today after rising through a field of 264 other competitors.
Please join me in congratulating the winner of the 77th annual Scripps National Spelling Bee, David Tidmarsh, representing South Bend from you, South Bend, Indiana. Congratulations.
David Tidmarsh successfully spelled the word autochthonous. His winnings include more than $18,000 in cash and prizes. Tidmarsh defeated Akshay Budiga, a 13-year-old boy from Colorado Springs. During the early rounds, Budiga collapsed on stage from an attack of lightheadedness but went on to gain second place. In stocks today, the S&P 500 lost 8 points to close at 1116. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When you call a toll-free number for customer service, the person on the other end of the line might be in India. Phone services are just one example of the many jobs corporations have started to outsource to countries where they can pay lower wages. My guest, Tom Friedman, is foreign affairs columnist for The New York Times, the winner of 3 Pulitzer Prizes, and the author of several best-selling books, including The Lexus and the Olive Tree, Understanding Globalization. He recently went to Bangalore, India, to report on outsourcing for his Times column and for his documentary, The Other Side of Outsourcing. It will be shown tonight on the Discovery Channel. We invited him back to Fresh Air to talk about outsourcing and to discuss his latest foreign affairs columns about Iraq. I asked him first to describe the typical jobs that have been outsourced to India.
Well, the ones that people are most familiar with, of course, Terry, are the call center jobs. And those fall into 2 categories, what they call in India outbound jobs or inbound jobs. That is, young Indians who may call you trying to sell you credit cards or phone service or banking service. And the inbound ones, which many of us are familiar with from our computers or our internet or our AOL service going wrong and calling looking for a young technical support worker to walk us through them. And so those are the ones we're most familiar with. The ones you're less familiar with probably are accounting. A lot of accounting firms are now outsourcing kind of basic tax returns to Indian accountants who are trained in American accounting methods and spread out all over India and may do the work, you know, in their spare time. Another very new and developing branch is that of radiology. There are Indian radiologists now reading x-rays for major American medical centers. There is an enormous amount of now raw R&D going on. There is book publishing editing going on in India. There's brokerage research into different countries and companies going on now in India. And then there's really very basic R&D involving pharmaceuticals, which is still at a kind of rudimentary level, but I think one of the real comers in that field as well. So, Terry, almost anything that can be digitized, anything that can be turned into ones and zeros and transmitted over phone lines or by satellite, can now really be outsourced to India or anywhere else.
Why India? Why is India such a capital of this outsourcing?
Well, it's a really good question. India had several accidental advantages, actually. The first was that it had a lot of people who spoke English. Second, it had obviously a huge population of low-wage labor. But thirdly, and most importantly, what made it all possible is it had a real tradition where in Indian families, the greatest thing you could be when you grew up was either a doctor or an engineer. And one of Nehru's great legacies was to set up a network of little MITs all over India. And so every year, India was graduating thousands upon thousands of very educated, well-trained, English-speaking engineers. And in a country of 1 billion people, it creates a kind of Darwinian environment. Just to get into one of these, what they're called IITs, Indian Institutes of Technology, is so competitive. And as a result of that, it's produced a generation of very hungry, very educated, and very sharp young people. And then there was one other accident that India, Terry, just happened to be almost exactly on the other side of the world from the United States. so that their night was our day and our day was their night. And as a result of that, you could create a 24-hour workday. Teams of American software designers could work on a product here, then ship it over to their Indian counterparts. They would work on it at night, answer questions, and ship it back. And so because of the time difference, it really was a perfect fit with us. Same with the call centers. When do you tend to get those calls from the credit card company or the phone company? It's usually around your dinner time or sometime in the evening when you're home from work. And that really fit in very nicely with the Indian day.
The bottom line of all of this is that companies that want to outsource can hire people in India at a much lower wage than they can in the United States. And that's where the real payoff is for the corporations. Would you compare some of the salaries of Indian workers and American workers for comparable jobs?
Well, the standard figure that people use is that Indian workers make about a fifth of what American workers use. That's a good ballpark number. So the call center workers, starting call center workers, make in the low 200s, and then as they work up, get more experience, and they also some work on commission, will make something like $300 a month, as opposed to what is the probably $1,500 a month or even more for a starting call center worker in the United States.
And in India, that translates into a decent salary.
Translates into not only a decent salary, as many of the young people we interviewed, Terry told us, a lot of them, as is the custom in India, turn over their whole paycheck to their parents and then just take some back as allowance because of the extended family and the tightness of the extended family there. So many of them are now making more in their starting jobs than their mothers and fathers are making in the last years of their purely Indian jobs. And, that's quite a revolution. They also have now enormous disposable income for their society, and they're using it to buy global brands, many of them American. I mean, you go into all of these call centers, and it's pretty easy to see free trade at work. You look around, the computers are, Dell and HP and Compaq. The software is all from Microsoft. The air conditioner is from Carrier. The water is even bottled by Coke. And they're wearing American clothes. You really can see the cycle there at work.
You know, on some level, this just sounds like really wonderful. High technology, speed of transmission of information, Indian people getting paid really, terrific wages, helping support their families, new jobs for young men and women in India. That all sounds really great, but there are so many Americans that don't have jobs, and jobs are now being outsourced more and more to other countries, and that's certainly seems to be making the unemployment problem here worse. So in that sense, it's really hard to be enthusiastic about this outsourcing.
Well, it's a really complicated issue. And you and I over the years have talked about globalization. And my mantra has always been, if you think it's all bad or you think it's all good, you don't understand it. And outsourcing, I would put in that very same category. You know, when you lose your job in this country, the unemployment rate isn't 4% or 5%. It's 100%. And we have to remember that. Free trade definitely is good for the society as a whole, and it's good for Indian society as a whole. Look what's happened. I mean, since the early 1990s, we've never had more outsourcing between America and India in the history of our two countries. And American exports to India during this period, during the last decade or so, have gone from $2.5 billion a year to over $4 billion a year. So that's a lot of jobs. That means a lot of stuff being made here is going over there. But at the same time, what concerns me most is not the call center jobs, because to me, call center jobs are outsourced in the same way that maybe your secretary or receptionist job was outsourced 10 years ago when we got voicemail chips in our telephones. Some things are outsourced to India, and some things, as my friend David Rothkopf says, are outsourced to the past. So there are a lot of airline counter employees who have been seen their jobs outsourced to the past because we now have e-ticket machines. So all of this churning is going on. I think it's the job of government in this society, in our society, and I certainly want my tax dollars used to not only cushion people with wage insurance and things of that nature who are caught up in this job churning, whether it's outsourcing to India or outsourcing to the past, and to help them acquire the skills in order to obviously access the better paying jobs.
Say we really are exporting a lot of new products to people in other countries, and part of the reason why there's a demand for these products is that they are making better wages through these outsourced jobs. So, like, more people in Bangalore are buying American products because they have taken these outsourced jobs that pay them a good wage. Terrific. But say the company making that product is an American company, but the factory is now located in Thailand because it's a cheaper wage there. So even the fact that more product from America is being shipped to this new market in Bangalore doesn't necessarily help the American worker because the people who made that product might not be in America.
Mm-hmm. And not only is that not an imaginary question, Dell Computer. What is Dell? Dell is actually a Chinese manufacturing company with an American website. But over here in America, you have the whole top level of Dell, the management, the sales team, you know, the key innovators, and they're making the highest wages in the company. And what have those profits allowed Dell to do? Okay, that because they're doing all this cheap manufacturing in China, it's to go into all of these other areas now. What has Dell been doing with its profits? Yes, Michael Dell has gotten rich, and the shareholders of Dell have gotten rich, and maybe in your pension fund and mine. But what they've also done with those profits is plowed back into Dell, okay, and say, you know what, we're just not going to be in the computer business. I think, you know, we at Dell, we're pretty good at this supply chain stuff. Let's go into the television business. Let's go in. Look what Amazon has done, how they've expanded. So I think you really can't see it in this narrow way. Yes, that is true. These companies are outsourcing, and then jobs of outsourced jobs get outsourced. But as long as profits are coming back here and then used to innovate and start new businesses, that's how you get continued aggregate growth in jobs. That's the history of free trade.
But might Dell be plowing the money for the new businesses into businesses in third world countries where the workers will get paid less? I mean, maybe they're not. I'm just using them as a hypothetical.
Not might they be. They are.
They are. Okay, so how is that helping us in America?
Right. What is helping is creating better Dell jobs here. Well, look, if you're a person whose skill was putting motherboards into Dell computers and you grew up in Austin, Texas, and that job's now been outsourced basically to Taiwan or to China, you have lost your job. You have been hurt by this process. If your job is computer designing for Dell, you are in better shape than ever. Your company's stronger than ever, and you're thinking about constantly how to make the next Dell computer. Now, the problem is that person making the motherboard and what we do to help them transition up the scale to be working somewhere else in Dell. That's the way this has to work. But if you're telling me the only thing we can do is not let those motherboards be made in Taiwan in order to preserve this specific job here, I tell you that Dell will be worse off, and all the workers of Dell will be worse off over time.
My guest is New York Times columnist Tom Friedman. His documentary, The Other Side of Outsourcing, will be shown tonight on the Discovery Channel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Friedman. He writes a foreign affairs column for the New York Times. His documentary, The Other Side of Outsourcing, will be shown tonight on the Discovery Channel. What do you think would be an enlightened government policy that would help American workers deal with these outsourcing kind of changes?
Well, this is, in my view, if there is one magic wand that I could wave, it's it would be about education. It would be making sure through government scholarships and government programs that absolutely the maximum number of Americans possible have an opportunity to have college-level education, either in the technical area or, you know, at the broader university area. At the same time, the second thing I would do would use the bully pulpit of the presidency to do everything I could to induce and encourage young Americans to go into engineering and hard sciences. And I would radically increase the amount of government aid to universities for just basic scientific research.
Well, here's another question. I know one of the things that you take heart from in terms of globalization is that, say, you look at India, not only a lot of American products being bought there now, but, you know, American culture has arrived there in full force, and a lot of the workers who are employed by American companies are really feeling quite good about America. They like American culture. They like American dollars. They like the American companies they're working for.
Oh, but Terry,
yeah?
The most important thing
yeah.
is that they like themselves.
Okay, yeah.
They feel good about themselves.
Yeah, well, that's great.
Not saying it's our job. I'm not saying it's our job to make people here feel bad about themselves so Indians can feel good about themselves, because I don't think it's a zero-sum game. But at the same time, one of the positive byproducts about this is that, you know, you're producing young people who don't want to blow up the world. They want to be part of it.
In your documentary, you go behind the scenes and you find a lot of the ways that people are trained for their new jobs in India. And one of the ways that they're trained is to speak American English, so that if I call an 800 number and I actually get somebody in Bangalore, I won't know they're in Bangalore. Now, are they trying to fool me, or are they just trying to make me comfortable?
Oh, both, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
They're both trying to fool you and to make you feel more comfortable talking to them. Their companies in Bangalore, to this technology has gotten so sophisticated that if you're in Philadelphia and you call, you know, company X, and that call gets routed to a call center in Bangalore, simultaneous with that call ringing at the desk of the Indian call center operator, on his or her screen comes up a little summary of the weather in Philadelphia, how the Phillies are doing, just some basic stuff on Philadelphia. And they can say, oh, hi, Terry. Weather's nice today. How about those Phillies? And it's gotten pretty sophisticated.
Wow. So do people actually do that?
Oh, yeah. Well, when they do engage in this kind of chatter, and they all take assumed names, or they're asked to take assumed names. So, you know, they might be called Rachel Smith, or, you know, one of the women in our documentary, that's the name she uses. And, you know, the idea is, as you say, it's both to fool you into thinking you're talking to an American or a Brit. Some of them work in British, you know, call centers and learn British accents. And the other is just to make you supposedly feel more comfortable.
How do the young Indian workers in these jobs feel about having to take an American name, having to learn an American accent, having to pretend like they actually follow what the Phillies are doing and that they know it's sunny and clear in Philly today?
Well, that's really one of the things we explore with them in the documentary. To what extent are they losing their own Indianness? And I would say, you know, our experience in talking to them, and we did 60 hours of interviews to do this, was that, you know, most of them just sort of see it as part of the job. They don't take it real seriously. You know, India as a country, one of the reasons it's been successful at globalization in a short period of time, like China, is that it's very good at glocalizing. Glocalization is really a key for a country's ability to engage in globalization. And glocalization means you're really good at taking kind of the best of the global economy and what it has to offer your society or culture, and melding it with your local, you know, norms and culture and whatnot. And Indians do this. It's in their DNA. You know, the Mughals come, the Mughals go. The British come, the British go. IBM and Hewlett-Packard and Microsoft come and they go, but we still wear saris, we still eat curry, we still live with our extended family. We found that when you scratch these kids underneath the patina of Levi jeans and cell phones and, you know, assumed accents, they were still hardcore Indians.
I seem to have mostly played the part of skeptic in this interview about outsourcing, and I had noticed. I'm wondering if you run into that all the time. If there are so many Americans who are so upset about losing jobs that they almost don't even want to hear about it.
Yeah, I do, and believe me, I really understand it. I take so seriously the idea of, you know, my neighbor or my kid or my kid's friend, you know, being swept up in this, you know. That's why I'm trying to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing I know as a journalist is my job is not to sit back and, you know, fan the flames of either jingoism or know-nothingism. It's to really try to delve into this phenomena. That's why we went all the way to India, did that. That's why I want to write a book on, because if I understand it, maybe I can contribute something to a sensible debate about it. Because the technology is here, and it is flattening the world, Terry. And unless we want to put up walls again, and then we'd pay a huge price in another way, we have to find a way to live with this, to limit the pain and maximize the benefits. And it does nobody any good to have a campaign where one side says you're supporting Benedict Arnold executives, and the other side, which believes in free trade, is afraid, so afraid to say so that it puts tape over the mouth of the chief White House economist. That's a sure prescription for getting us in trouble because, you know, as I said earlier, while we've been engaged in the war on terrorism, India, China, these big companies, they're eating our lunch. They are getting ready for this flat world. And I don't want to wake up 5 years from now and discover that while we were sleeping or otherwise engaged, that we've really put ourselves behind the eight ball. So I'm trying to write about it sensibly, but the problem was you get in these situations and you become a defender of it. I'm neither a defender nor nor someone rejecting it. I'm trying to understand the phenomena, explain to myself and hopefully to others the benefits and the costs.
Tom Friedman will be back in the second half of the show to talk about his New York Times foreign affairs columns on Iraq. His documentary, The Other Side of Outsourcing, will be shown tonight on the Discovery Channel. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback Beyond Belief by Elaine Pagels, author of The Gnostic Gospels. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with New York Times foreign affairs columnist Thomas Friedman about his recent columns on Iraq. Last month, he wrote that he'd made a mistake in thinking the Bush administration would place more importance on doing the right things in Iraq than on getting reelected. Also, book critic Maureen Carrigan reviews Ann Patchett's new memoir, Truth and Beauty of Friendship.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of the interview we recorded yesterday with Tom Friedman. He writes a foreign affairs column for the New York Times. He's won 3 Pulitzer Prizes and is the author of several best-selling books. In the first half of the interview, we talked about his documentary, The Other Side of Outsourcing, which will be shown tonight on the Discovery Channel. Tom, I want to change subjects for a little while here and talk about your work as a political columnist for the New York Times, in which I should say you've also written a lot about globalization, including a lot about outsourcing of jobs to India. But I want to actually talk a little bit about Iraq.
Sure.
You had felt very strongly that overthrowing Saddam Hussein would be a good thing and that it would not only bring democracy to Iraq, it would help create a model of democracy in that part of the world and help or at least inspire other countries to democratize. On May 13th, you wrote a column in which you expressed your concern that things had gone so wrong that it was maybe just too late. So let me just read an excerpt of that column. You wrote...
Can I just ask you to... Because it's really an overstatement of my... I had a very tightly, argued, and since we talked about this, approach to this war, and it was based on 2 simple mantras.
Yeah.
This could be the right war if it was done right.
Yes, exactly.
And that it would not bring instant democracy, but that it would begin to tilt, the Middle East in the right direction by creating what I called a decent Iraq. I always try to use the word decent, okay, because I know first you have to have decency before democracy. So I just have to beg of you to... If I'm happy to answer any question about my position, but it has to be my real position, not a caricature of it.
Perfect. Thank you. So now I'm going to read an excerpt of your column from May 13th. You wrote, "It is time to ask this question. Do we have any chance of succeeding at regime change in Iraq without regime change here at home? Hey, Friedman, why are you bringing politics into this all of a sudden? You're the guy who always said that producing a decent outcome in Iraq was of such overriding importance to the country that it had to be kept above politics. Yes, that's true. I still believe that. My mistake was thinking that the Bush team believed it, too. I thought the administration would have to do the right things in Iraq, from pre-war planning and putting in enough troops to dismissing the Secretary of Defense for incompetence, because surely this was the most important thing for the president and the country. But I was wrong. There's something even more important to the Bush crowd than getting Iraq right, and that's getting reelected and staying loyal to the conservative base to do so." I was wondering, what was the turning point for you in deciding to write that column and deciding to say that you thought the Bush administration had basically blown it, that they were putting politics above doing the right thing in Iraq?
It was Rumsfeld. It was the fact that in the wake of Abu Ghraib, which was such a stain on our effort in Iraq and our status in the world, but which came after a year of utter incompetence. And as you know, because we talked about this during the course of that year, in which I've been arguing and complaining from the very beginning about the sheer incompetent way in which the Pentagon has prosecuted this war, I felt that at this stage in the game, if the president couldn't and wouldn't fire Rumsfeld for purely political reasons, in my view, that there was little hope that we can win this war without regime change at home.
Was this a difficult column to write, and did you try a lot of different leads before going with the one that you used?
You know, Terry, the best columns take you about a half hour to write.
Mm-hmm.
You start at the top, and you stop at the bottom because they just come out of you, and this one just came out of me. And I probably got more mail on that column, than I've gotten, on any in a long, long time. And it just really expressed what I felt all along, which is that this could be the right war. It had to be done right. And my position before the war was right war, but you got to do it right. And then when they went to war, I said, this column is going to be used to try to turn lemons into lemonade. They clearly didn't go into it the right way, but I still believe the stakes here are so big. They are so important in turning this part of the world in a different direction. And as you know, I never believed in WMD. That was not my reason for the war. It was all about the war of ideas to try to tilt that part of the world in a different direction. I believed it was so important, I made a choice, and it's a choice I have to live with, that I want to use my column to try to be a voice, one voice, but try to be a voice to encourage the right actions there that would maximize our chances for getting the right outcome, even though we didn't do it right. And throughout the year, that was really the position I took. And I finally reached a stage where it was clear to me that while getting Iraq right was the most important thing for me, I believe, the most important thing for our country, and something very important for the future of the world my kids are going to live in. It was not the most important thing for the Bush administration. Getting reelected was the most important thing for them. And so many of their mistakes and so many of the things they wouldn't do were all traceable to politics.
Can you give me some example of,
Sure, yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We can just go right, they're all in that column, but you can go right down the list.
Mm-hmm.
Not having a serious Arab-Israeli policy, basically jumping into bed with Ariel Sharon, a terrible thing to be doing at a time when we're trying to build a decent Iraq in Baghdad, number one. Not having an energy policy, not using the opportunity of the Iraq war to enlist Americans in sacrifice for energy conservation and to begin a Manhattan Project to foster energy independence. Terry, as my friend Paul Romer says, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. And we had a crisis here that people really would have been mobilized to contribute to energy independence. And by the way, gas wouldn't be $2.75 a gallon today if they had done that. That's number two. Number three, going to our allies, drawing them into this process, even saying, I'm sorry. Again, for political reasons, they weren't going to do that. They weren't going to do the energy thing because they get all their money from the oil and gas lobby. And lastly, going right back to the beginning of the war, why didn't Rumsfeld put the number of troops we needed in there? Because he wanted to prove that Colin Powell was wrong. He wanted to prove that the Powell doctrine of using overwhelming force to take over a country like this, that you didn't need to do that anymore, that a high-tech, fast, small army could do it. These people in the Pentagon, these ideologues, wanted to defeat Colin Powell much more than they wanted to defeat Saddam Hussein. So for all those reasons, I basically concluded that these guys were really incapable of doing the right thing, that their own ideology and domestic politics would make it impossible. And therefore, to really have any chance of succeeding anymore at regime change in Iraq, we really need a regime change at home.
Now, I want to quote something you wrote on May 6th in your New York Times column. You wrote, I've never known a time in my life when America and its president were more hated around the world than today. Now, I know you have a lot of sources around the world, including heads of state. I'm wondering, what are some of the things you've been hearing?
I don't interview a lot of heads of state, so I really couldn't tell you what they're thinking, and none of them would confide in me. But I talk to a lot of normal people around the world. And I see kind of two trends that have come together that really made this administration very unpopular. And some are things that are justified and some are things that are not justified. The justified things are the kind of sneering unilateralism of this administration, that everyone else is a dummy, that things like the Kyoto Treaty on global warming, that's for sissies. Things like the Geneva Conventions don't have to restrain us. And things like, you know, steel tariffs, even if it contradicts our Republican free tradeism, too bad, you're just going to have to eat it. That kind of attitude is something that has made people very, very angry around the world. Then there's something that I think is more complicated if we're going to be honest about it. It's that the world, you know, they're very ready to love us and be sympathetic to the United States when we're wounded or when we're weak. But generally speaking, they don't really like us when we exercise power. You know, there are a lot of people in Europe yelping about the American invasion of Afghanistan to root out Osama bin Laden. Let's not forget that, let alone Iraq, where we really went in defiance of the world. And so, as I say, some of the opprobrium heaped on the Bush administration, I think, is really justified. It melds together with stuff that I think is more knee-jerk. But here's the totality that I think has been created out there, Terry. It's a sense that people love to make fun of America. They love to make fun of our naivete. They love to make fun of our sense that every problem has a solution. They love to make fun of our optimism. And I think what's really at the bottom of the real hatred of Bush is a sense that he's taken that away. You see, even though they make fun of our naivete and our optimism, they deeply envy it. They deeply need it. American optimism is what makes the world go round. People need an optimistic America. And then come along these really cynical guys called Bush and Cheney, and then comes 9/11. And the America that always was the biggest exporter of hope in the world turns into the biggest exporter of fear. And when you export fear, what you end up doing is importing everyone else's fears back. And what I sense, and I may not be quite able to put my finger on this, is that there's a deep sense of loss in the world that both justifiably and maybe unjustifiably, there's a sense that these guys have stolen our America. The America that is that naive, optimistic country that I always wanted to move to, that I always looked up to, that I could always count on as a beacon of hope, an opportunity, even under the thumb of my own cynical government. And it's that sense of loss that I think feeds a lot of the really visceral hatred of this administration.
You wrote in one of your columns, and I'm paraphrasing here, so correct me if I'm misrepresenting you in any way, but you wrote basically that we have to convince the Iraqis that no matter how many suicide bombers come at us, we're staying until we help stabilize the country. And now America is going to be handing over sovereignty to Iraq at the end of this month. Do you think that we're withdrawing too quickly before Iraq is in good enough shape to handle the new issues of democracy?
This is a really complicated moment and situation, so let me just tell you how I'm kind of sorting it out in my own head. And I wrote those lines, of course, before we had this caretaker government.
Mm-hmm.
I believe we're really at the moment of truth for Iraq. And the moment of truth is, how will Iraqis behave once we finally hand them the keys? Is there an Iraq there? Are they capable of working together? I believe that to maximize our chances that this experiment will, tilt in a positive way rather than a negative way, we need to give them the maximum amount of sovereignty they demand and want. And if they want control over, all military actions in the country except our own self-defense, I would give them on paper whatever they want. In reality, we'll always have to work it out, whatever we negotiate on paper. But I think it's very important that they be perceived, that they perceive themselves and they be perceived by their own people as sovereign and in charge, and that we recede into the background. I think that's going to enable them, first of all, to find out who they are and give us the best chance that they will stand on their own two legs. So am I in favor of withdrawing from Iraq tomorrow? No, because I don't think Iraqis want that. But the minute that Iraqis do want that, boy, I'm all in favor of it. And that's what I think we should be guided by. And this kind of lingering sense of this administration that they want to control things, get over it. We can't control it. Iraq will be ultimately what Iraqis make of it.
My guest is New York Times foreign affairs columnist Tom Friedman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Friedman. He writes a foreign affairs column for the New York Times and has won 3 Pulitzer Prizes. You've been reporting from the Middle East for years. You won a Pulitzer Prize for your reporting from Beirut. You wrote a best-selling book that probably a lot of our listeners have read called From Beirut to Jerusalem. Do you think that there are any lessons for us that the Arab-Israeli crisis has to offer?
Oh, many, Terry. I've had this feeling for a while now that the Arab-Israeli conflict is to the war on terrorism what the Spanish Civil War was to World War II. It's the off-Broadway theater where all the weapons and all the bad ideas get tested out in miniature first. And, whether it was hijacking or car bombing or suicide bombing, or using terrorism to influence democratic elections, they all started there off Broadway in the Arab-Israeli theater. And I look at where that Arab-Israeli theater is going today, and they're building a wall. And what I desperately don't want, but desperately fear, that if things in Iraq really do go badly, if we cannot help there be a war within Islam between progressives and the darker forces, if we cannot encourage a war within Islam, a war of ideas, then I fear there'll be a war with Islam, that we will build a wall, we the West, against that part of the world, just as happened in miniature in Israel. You know, I was in Israel on 9/11 by accident. I was there covering the Intifada. And the morning after, on the morning of 9/12, I had a briefing from Israeli terrorism experts because I wanted to understand what they learned about suicide bombing. And I said, what should we know? What have you all learned from this? And they taught me a lesson that day, which they've forgotten, but I haven't. And the message was, Tom, if there's one thing we learned, it's that the only people who can stop suicide bombers are Palestinians. Oh, we can get lucky. We can penetrate a cell here or a cell there. But at the end of the day, it takes a village. Only Ahmed, you know, knows what Muhammad is doing. And only Arabs and Muslims can delegitimize this process and thereby bring it to an end. And we can't do that. And that insight that they had, Terry, has really been one of the huge motivators for me and my position on Iraq. As you know, I didn't believe this was about WMD. What I believed it was about is a war of ideas, that there are too many people in the Arab world today who believe bad things. They believe in ideas of intolerance, anti-pluralism, repression of women. They believe bad things. Look what happened in Saudi Arabia just last week. These militants came into a Western compound, and the first thing they said is, infidels over here, Arabs and Muslims over here. Infidels, you're hostages, or you're going to be killed. Arabs and Muslims, go away. Those are bad ideas, and they come out of the Saudi education system. And it seemed to me that in a world without walls, the only way to make us safe is to try to partner with progressive forces over there, to try to tilt that region in another direction so they can have the war of ideas within and obviously have the more progressive forces defeat the more obscurantist ones. We had a civil war in our country 150 years ago over the same sorts of issues. Terry, it may all be a fool's errand. It may all be a fool's errand, what I hoped for out of this, although I think it's way too soon to tell. But if it is, then we're going to have to build a wall.
So you had hoped that the regime change in Iraq would be the kind of partnering you're talking about between progressive forces.
But I want to really emphasize something that's implicit in your question. I do not think it's over, okay? And there's way too much, I don't know, out there today of via hia and mea culpa. I'll take all my lumps, you know, when this goes down. You know, I can't run away from a year and a half full worth of columns, and I have no desire to. But can we at least let this play out? What I absolutely don't understand is just at the moment when we finally have a UN-approved Iraqi caretaker government made up of, I know a lot of these guys, reasonably decent people, and more than reasonably decent people, everyone wants to declare it's over. I don't get it. It might be over in a week. It might be over in a month. It might be over in 6 months. But what's the rush? Can we let this play out, please?
So you're standing by and seeing what happens.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, did somebody turn over an egg timer here and say, you know, now is the time where for anyone who believes this might have a decent outcome to apologize? Who declared this National Iraq Apology Day?
Well, I have one last question for you. And, you know, you've been on the show several times in the past couple of years. And one of the things you've said a couple of times on the show, and this was just before the war in Iraq, you used what you described as a pottery barn analogy, that we should go into Iraq with the understanding that if we break it, we own it, like in the pottery barn. You break one of their tchotchkes, you own it, you've bought it. My understanding is that in Bob Woodward's book, he attributes that phrase to Colin Powell, and I can't tell you how many talk shows I've heard where they say Colin Powell used what he describes as the pottery barn analogy. So set me straight here.
Well, bless your heart, Terry, because you know that I invented the pottery barn phrase, and I used it on your show numerous times a year before the war, okay, not to mention on other shows and in my own column. And what happened was, in all honesty, I used it with Rich Armitage, the Deputy Secretary of State, and he used it with Colin Powell without attributing it to me, and Colin Powell used it with the president. The three of us had a chat last week.
Oh, really?
And he told me what happened. Yeah. And Paul went on Larry King and said it did come from Tom Friedman.
So, oh, I didn't know that. Great.
Yeah, so, well, he went on Larry King to say it came from Tom Friedman. Why? Because the Pottery Barn complained. They said, we have no such rule. If you break it, you don't have to own it.
Oh, I saw that part. I saw Paul, the publicist talking about
that.
Yeah,
that's right. So Paul said, it's not my fault. It's Tom Friedman's fault. So.
Well, that's great. So that's the only way you get credit when people want to deny
exactly.
that.
You know, suddenly they want to sue him. You know, it's back to my idea. But I tell you, Terry, I'm glad he used it with the president. I'm only really sad that the president didn't listen.
Well, Tom Friedman, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure as always.
Tom Friedman is a foreign affairs columnist for The New York Times. He reports on the migration of jobs to India in the new documentary, The Other Side of Outsourcing. It will be shown tonight on the Discovery Channel. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan reviews Ann Patchett's new memoir about her friendship with the late writer Lucy Greeley. This is Fresh Air. Ann Patchett is best known for her novel Bel Canto, which won, among other prizes, the Penn Faulkner Award in 2001. For almost two decades, Patchett's best friend was fellow writer Lucy Greeley. Greeley is known to many readers for her best-selling memoir Autobiography of a Face, which described the childhood cancer that destroyed her jaw and left her face permanently ravaged. Greeley's death in 2002 was deemed partly a consequence of her heroin addiction and increasing dependence on prescription painkillers. Now Ann Patchett has written a memoir called Truth and Beauty about her intense friendship with Greeley, but critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
About 6 months ago, a friend emailed me asking for recommendations for a literature course a friend of hers was putting together. The topic of the proposed course was women's friendships. I emailed back some suggestions, none of them startling. Jane Austen's Emma, Vera Brittain's Testament of Friendship, Barbara Pym's Jane and Prudence. Clearly, I was in a Brit-lit rut. Now along comes the book that anyone interested in accounts of women's friendships or the equally underexplored topic of women's ambition should read. Novelist Ann Patchett has written an extraordinary autobiography called Truth and Beauty, about her long friendship with autobiographer and poet Lucy Greeley. Although it's written, obviously, in prose, Truth and Beauty also figures as a breakthrough book for women in another overwhelmingly male literary category, the elegy. The classical elegies were written by male poets about their dead male friends, Milton's Lycidas, Tennyson's In Memoriam. In Truth and Beauty, we have the unique situation of a female writer composing a raucous contemporary prose elegy for her dead female writer friend. In a non-sentimental way, Patchett manages to do what the great classical elegists also accomplished. She holds death at bay, in this case, Greeley's death at bay, through the vital power of words, mostly her own, augmented by selections from some of Greeley's letters. Both Patchett and Greeley were undergraduates at Sarah Lawrence College. Patchett knew who Greeley was. Everyone at Sarah Lawrence did. Greeley was a celebrity because of her elfin exuberance and her looks. Part of Greeley's jaw was missing, the consequence of childhood cancer, and she would endure nearly 40 surgeries in her life in an ultimately failed attempt to build up her face. The two women became friends when, out of economic necessity, they shared a crummy graduate student apartment. They were both accepted into the prestigious Iowa Writers' Workshop. During the day, they taught freshman English classes, and afterwards they'd write and read each other's works in progress and talk about lovers and drink beers and dance in the kitchen. Patchett hilariously recalls how the flat-chested Greeley, whose breasts didn't develop because of childhood radiation treatments, decided to use a student loan to pay for a boob job. "The best thing I ever got out of graduate school," Greeley happily said after the operation. From their first days together, Patchett fell into a caretaker role. She characterizes herself as the sensible tortoise to Greeley's spendthrift hair. Patchett cleaned their apartment and cooked what they referred to as Lucy food, half-done pancakes and other soft food that Greeley, with great effort, could swallow. Greeley, as Patchett describes her, was also an emotional handful. She craved attention and would routinely jump into Patchett's lap and ask to be carried like a child, and she'd also succumb to bouts of sobbing. What Greeley assumed would be her salvation, what Patchett, after Iowa, prayed would rescue her from a lifetime of waitressing, was writing. Both women, gifted with much talent and some luck, made it, and Truth and Beauty chronicles their joint journey out of the garret and onto the literary gravy train. After her enormous success with Autobiography of a Face, however, Greeley hit a writing block and sank deeper into debt, as well as depression over her career and the endless series of failed reconstructive surgeries. Prescription drugs and heroin gave her relief and finally took her life. Patchett doesn't shy away from recording Greeley in full because despite her physical and psychological neediness, Greeley was Patchett's soulmate, coming through for her in a way no one else could. Here's how Patchett describes their friendship. It's the best description of being with a close friend that I've ever read. "Even when Lucy was devastated or difficult, she was the person I knew best in the world, the person I was the most comfortable with. Whenever I saw her, I felt like I had been living in another country, doing moderately well in another language. And then she showed up speaking English, and suddenly I could speak with all the complexity and nuance that I hadn't even realized was gone. With Lucy, I was a native speaker." Truth and Beauty is a magnificent memoir about friendship and the love of literature, and also, sadly, the limited consolations of friendship and literature against unremitting pain.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Truth and Beauty by Ann Patchett. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback, The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime by Mark Haddon. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Christopher Walken. He's in the new version of The Stepford Wives. Also, screenwriter and novelist Richard Price. His latest novel, Samaritan, is now out in paperback. Join us for the next Fresh Air.